is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
The Indo-Pacific, vast ocean landscape, the islands, and the concern right now that in 2027, if not before, the People's Liberation Army, Navy, and Air Force will attack and overwhelm Taiwan. What is to be done? I welcome Patrick Tucker, the technology editor of Defense One, to comment on what he learned in his trip to the Indo-Pacific about preparations, about coordination, about experimentation to work effectively not only with the Taiwanese Air Force and Navy, but also with our allies in the region. That would be Australia, Japan, the Philippines, possibly India, but certainly coordinating all of this over that scale of ocean is a challenge for anyone. And then there's the twist that surveillance is very good for the Chinese, and they'll be listening. Patrick, a very good evening to you. The statistic in your story that knocked me backwards, now I understand what the Navy and the Army are concerned about. It's called centerline crossing, 200 times or more so far by the PLA Navy. What does that mean, Patrick? What are they watching? Good evening to you.
Good evening. So yes, Indo-Pacific Command has, for a few years now, been sounding the alarm on increasingly aggressive Chinese maneuverings toward Taiwan. And that, of course, feeds into their argument that the U.S. and the U.S. military must increase its focus on the region. It's something that the Office of the Secretary of Defense agrees, and they are doing that. 200 central line crossings this year, that speaks to the number of times Chinese military forces, particularly jets, have crossed over that line that is sort of understood to be the dividing line between Taiwanese water territory and Chinese water territory. And the thing about that is not only is it kind of like a stunt to provoke fear and intimidation in the Taiwanese, because China has so many planes, they have so many naval assets, they have the world's largest navy at this point, those crossings will exhaust the Taiwanese radar operators, their rapid response force. And so you've got folks that are just constantly like watching this, figuring out what to do, figuring out what sort of response is appropriate. So it does have an actual effect of slowly kind of eroding readiness just through exhaustion. And that's a sign of what to come. One official that I spoke to, an intelligence official that didn't want to be named, sort of boot-stamped what Admiral Davidson had said in testimony in 2021, which is that China may well attempt a takeover of Taiwan on the outset by 2027. You get a little bit further than that, and it starts to look not as good for him. That is the year by which Chinese President Xi Jinping has said his military has to be ready for that. 2029 is the year by which Taiwanese forces are expected to finish their modernization efforts. That gives you this real short window, if you're China, to pull off this takeover if you're going to do it. After that, it becomes increasingly costly and unattractive. So that is absolutely not a guarantee or a certainty that they are going to make that attempt, but they certainly are going to be prepared to do it, and that is the kind of optimal year to pull it off. So that puts the U.S. military now in a position where they have to really focus a lot of technology efforts, do a lot of exercises to hopefully show China that that move would be too costly, too risky, and ultimately a failure.
The Air Force, the Navy, the Army, the Marines, all increasing the tempo of their practicing, of their exercises. Let's begin with the Air Force. You report that there's right now underway the largest ever mobility exercise in the Pacific. What does that mean?
Right. So this is a new type of exercise that, you know, in the past, you would have exercises that were kind of focused on a specific service. This is Mobility Guardian 23, which is the largest full-scale readiness exercise that's ever been done. And part of the point here is to show and to test and to drill not just how jets and fighters and bombers are going to do their maneuvers, but also things like logistics, transcom. And every official that I spoke to said that, man, getting that logistics trail in place, particularly to deal with contested logistics, where you don't have a permissive environment like the U.S. had in the Middle East, where every from the point of deployment, almost from the point of recruitment to the point of combat, you are being tested by the adversary. So that is why that exercise is now expanded, Mobility Guardian 23. But that's just one of many different exercises that they're really ramping up. They are taking what were once service-specific exercises, like a Navy exercise, an Army exercise, Air Force, and really mushing them together into joint exercises in a way that they haven't previously. But also, and this is really important, working in partner militaries in the region in a way they hadn't before either. So particularly the Philippines, which is going to be absolutely critical to any U.S. readiness and any U.S. deterrence effort there. But additionally, Australia is playing a much larger role in these exercises. And the point there is to kind of create the same sort of unified effect that you see in Europe right now, where you have a multitude of nations that stood up to support Ukraine, that showed that they could help with a lot of logistics, at least from the European perspective, and that has had an effect on that conflict. This is to show that really China would face a united regional confrontation if they were to undertake something really risky like a unilateral military takeover of Taiwan in the next 2 years.
The military loves acronyms, and so I have to guess how to pronounce it. RADR. Rapid Defense Experimentation Reserve. What is that?
Right. So this is one of the big technology efforts that Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks has put into place to help bulk up the technology capabilities of Indo-Pacific Command in the service there. So you look across the services, you find new technologies that are going to have joint relevance, right? So in the past, when a service like the Navy would have a research budget, they would develop some cool Navy weapon, some cool Navy tool, and then they would fund it out of the Navy, and then other services could maybe use it, and that takes forever. So what they're trying to do here with this program is find new technologies that every service can use potentially at once. And that way, you have a dedicated funding stream for them. You cut through a lot of the bureaucracy that when I talk to kind of technology folks, so when I talk to innovators, they say that, you know, Pentagon buying bureaucracy is actually this huge problem. The intent here is to cut through that to make sure that every service can go in and use something that's acquired right away. And I saw a couple of these things, and they're really pretty amazing. You have, for instance, a tool like a drone that can go out, detect specific radio signals, different electromagnetic waveforms. So, for instance, it detects like the waveform of a particular adversary ship, and then it can mimic that so that the adversary thinks that there are a lot of ships in the region or things like that, and it doesn't know where to shoot. It doesn't know where to aim. So it just clouds their entire understanding of what the environment looks like based on what their sensors are like. There's a lot of electromagnetic warfare, things like that. There's tools that will allow operators to use adversarial telecom networks for their own purposes in a way that's secure. So you could be in a place like Singapore using a Huawei Chinese telecom network because you have to put data on that to get to, you know, your command or to get to one of your partner militaries. It would normally be intercepted. I mean, really quickly, Chinese cyber operators are the best in the world, perhaps not as good as the United States, but that's an open question. And this allows you to use that adversary telecom network for your own basically military purposes. There's a ton of things like that. And there's a few more that they couldn't show me, but those relate to things like that you can imagine long-range fires, so missiles, air defense, critical for Taiwan, and of course for the U.S. in places like Guam, South Korea, et cetera. So things like that. And the point of this program is to really accelerate the ability to deploy that stuff in the theater.
So the Philippines can communicate with the U.S. or Australia or Japan, and they can communicate without concern of surveillance by the Chinese. Is that what they're aiming for? That's a big, big project.
Yeah, it is a big project, but this is part of one of the things that they're trying to do there, and that's very much key. And one of the other things that officials told me when I went out there to visit them is that it's actually these partner militaries, these countries like the Philippines, like Singapore, like Malaysia, like Indonesia, who are asking for this stuff because that is going to give them better leverage against the Chinese. It's different from Europe. They know that China is going to be a trading partner with them for a very long time. They're aware of that. They're not looking to necessarily provoke China into a conflict. They want to avoid that at pretty much any cost, but not at every cost. And so they want to increase their leverage, their bargaining position, and their deterrent strength by forming something like a union that can then be in a good position to communicate with China with strength, with the understanding that they're going to be doing business with China for forever.
And that is a way of talking about the Pacific multi-domain training and experimentation. That's the same thing as radar, not very different. Communication between militaries and between ships. Is that they're anticipating a kind of it's a kind of war that you fight in video games. It's that fantastic, the ability to talk to a ship that's not in your Navy.
Right. So there's two things. There's this telecommunications effort that lets you use an adversarial like phone network. If you have to get a message out, you're in theater. And then there's this thing, this multi-domain test and experimentation. It's basically like a web interface, right? Now you're going to be able to link together your military, all your partner militaries in a virtual environment that lets you see what everyone is doing, that gives you like, and everyone else, a window into command and control. You can build up a lot of virtual assets if you want to test different war scenarios. You want to see how different war plans are going to play out. And you can actually drill the crews on those vessels without them being physically there. So you can keep something in port and then still drill the crew on a different scenario or exercise. And so that's just basically a big kind of war room where everyone can figure out how to execute plans, develop plans in the event that they have to do something, some sort of conflict scenario with China, so that there's practice that they all are on the same page, they all understand what's going on. And that's also very crucial if you're going to have some sort of coherent multi-service, multi-partner, you know, multi-military response to a potential Chinese invasion.
Patrick, you traveled to the Indo-Pacific and to the commands. Is there a sense of haste?
I would say not only is there a sense of haste, there's almost a sense of urgency, tremendous urgency. They understand this timeline that you've got until 2027. If that's the thing you're looking at, you don't want to have a surprise next year, the year or the year after that. 2024, you have very important elections in Taiwan and, of course, very important elections in the United States. So, yeah, they really feel like they're under the gun here.
Patrick Tucker is the technology editor for Defense One. We're going to the remains of Vilnius, what Patrick sees as the most significant events coming out of the Gathering of Eagles. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Patrick.